Hello, my name is David Wall. On behalf of CME Outfitters, I'd like to welcome you and thank you for joining us for today's educational activity titled A Grassroots Approach to Weed Out HIV and Hepatitis C in Special Opioid Use Disorder Populations. This activity is brought to you by CME Outfitters, an award-winning accredited provider of continuing education for clinicians around the globe. Also, today's program has been designed to meet the requirements of both MOC and as a MIPS improvement activity. Your participation by answering polling question and completing the evaluation and post-test is the first step of this process. After today's program, incorporate the clinical improvements we discuss, and in 2 to 3 months, CME Outfitters will send you a survey to complete, which will fulfill the data requirements. You will then receive confirmation and can submit to CMS. It's really that easy. I'm David Wall, Professor of Medicine and site leader of the Global HIV Prevention and Treatment Research Site at the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill School of Medicine in North Carolina. Joining me today are two of my colleagues, Dr. Jamie Meyer and Carlos Malvasuto. Dr. Malvasuto is an assistant professor of the Division of Infectious Diseases at Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center in Columbus, Ohio. Welcome, Carlos.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Also joining me is Dr. Jamie Meyer. She's assistant professor of medicine at the AIDS program at Yale University School of Medicine. She's also a clinical assistant professor in the Division of Primary Care Health Systems in Nursing at the Yale School of Nursing in New Haven, Connecticut. Thanks for being here, Jamie.
Thank you.
So before we get started, it'd be good for us to understand a little bit more about our audience. And so we're going to have some questions in which we're going to ask you to reply a little bit about your practice. So the first one is, what proportion of your practice is represented by people living with HIV? And the choices are A, less than 10%, B, 10% to 25%, C, 26 to 50%, D, 51 to 75%, or E, 76 to 100%. Next question is, have you ever written a prescription for hepatitis C therapy? A yes or no? A yes, B no. And lastly, have you ever prescribed PrEP, HIV PrEP? Again, A is yes, B is no. We'll come back to those answers later on. So for our first learning objective, we're going to look at implementing strategies for HIV and hepatitis C testing in special OUD populations and correctional VA and rural settings. The opioid epidemic has substantially increased the risk of hepatitis C and HIV through injection drug use. There are unique challenges that we face in providing care to patients in this population. In this section, we will address these barriers of HIV and hepatitis C testing within OUD populations and also discuss strategies to improve testing, especially within these special settings, correctional, VA, and rural settings. So, Carlos, I'm going to start with you. I think it'd be great just to have an overview, a little bit of the epidemiology of what we're talking about. Let's start with HIV. So give us like where we are today in the HIV epidemic and who's getting infected and diagnosed.
Sure. So as the audience probably knows, there are about 1.2 million people living with HIV in the United States currently. And every year there are about between 38,000 to 40,000 new cases of HIV per year. And then when we look at who is becoming infected and, you know, what are the risk factors, we see that for males, it is primarily male-to-male sexual contact, which is more than about 82% of new infections. When we look at injection drug use as the main cause of transmission, it's about 4% or so. And then we also have some that have shared risk factors, so MSM as well as injection drug use, which is about another 4%. When we look at females, then it's primarily through heterosexual contact, which is more than 80%. But we also see that there is a significant proportion that is infected through injection drug use, and that's about 14% currently. Mm-hmm. Now, these are numbers that were given the current opioid epidemic. We're seeing that the proportion of those who acquire HIV through injection drug use may be increasing gradually.
And maybe especially among women. Absolutely. That's really interesting. So this is helpful because it helps us understand who's getting infected and how they're getting infected and what the numbers are. 1.2 million, it's a lot of people. 350 million people in the country means that one out of every 350 million people are HIV infected. When we talk about HIV, we've been talking a lot lately about the cascade, which kind of gives us this big picture. And Jamie, I'm going to ask you to kind of describe this for us, because we talk about, you know, of the people, the 1.2 million, how many know that they're infected, and then all the way down to how many are in treatment and get their viral load suppressed. But we're learning as well that people who inject drugs may not be the same as everyone else with HIV. Can you break that down for us a little bit?
Yeah, so we know overall, you know, in the U.S., of all these people living with HIV, about 86% are diagnosed. And then we have a fall off, right, from those who are diagnosed to about 63% are actually linked to care, 49% started on antiretroviral therapy, and 51% successfully achieve HIV viral suppression. Now, it's a little different by gender, but among people who inject drugs, we see actually a higher proportion are getting diagnosed. You know, they are somehow engaging with healthcare systems enough to get diagnosed, but the fall off then for them to get linked to care, started on treatment, and ultimately achieve viral suppression, the cascade overall looks a bit worse.
Yeah, it's worse, because if you have more people who are diagnosed and the same proportion get into care,
right,
that shows you that the step off is the cascade, if you will, is steeper or greater. So that is really concerning, and I think it points to some of the issues. One thing we've also seen is that there's regional, and we'll come back to this time and time again, there's regional differences in all the types of care we're talking about for HIV and hepatitis C. And in the South, where most of the people with HIV now reside, about half, and where half the new cases are, those cases you describe, about half of those occur in the South. We also see that there's racial and ethnic disparities as well that are pretty significant, where we see that among new diagnoses, disproportionate to representation in populations, even in the South, predominantly people of color. So this is a really big challenge for us and still continues to be persistent for a variety of reasons, some of which we'll get into today and some of which are beyond the scope, but are really important to consider as well when we think about who to screen, where we should be concentrating our screening activities.
Right.
So I think one illustrative, unfortunately, and notorious example that maybe, Carlos, you can break down for us a little bit is what happened in Scotts County, Indiana a few years ago that I think really brings together really why we're even doing this program. You know, talking about HIV and hepatitis C.
Right. And I think, you know, it's very important to consider where are we seeing the new infections and where should we really be focusing and targeting our interventions. Mm-hmm. So CDC has identified 220 counties around the U.S. that are at the greatest risk of injection drug use associated HIV outbreaks. Now, a very large proportion of these counties are actually rural counties. And then we can see on the map here that there is a large number of these in the Appalachia area. So, you know, for many of my patients from southern Ohio, for example, and West Virginia. What we see in these cases is there are networks of people who may be using drugs and who are sharing drugs. And in the case of Scott County, a rural county in Indiana, in 2014 to 2015, there was an outbreak where in a very short period of time, we saw over 180 new HIV cases. And again, in a pretty small area,
right,
where typically there are very few new HIV infections.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this, and when you look at the population, so this was a network of patients who use drugs, the majority of them were hepatitis C infected.
Right.
But then, you know, in a short course of time, you saw all these new HIV infections. So this is what we tend to see. Since then, we have seen new outbreaks in other areas, you know, with similar patterns where initially it's the hepatitis C that we see, and then it's followed by HIV, where all you need is, like, you know, a few new infections, and then within that network, and then it spreads very
The kindling rapidly. Is there, and I think what we saw was really a forest fire of an outbreak, you know, both hepatitis C and HIV in an area that was primed for it. Poverty, unemployment, idleness, intergenerational drug use, hopelessness, big opioid prescription pill opioid epidemic that then translated into needle sharing. So really, those elements are in many parts of the country, including those that are highlighted here in the green, that spans to really some neglected areas. So I think this is a really, really illustrative case of why we're talking about this. This can happen. This will happen again. Mm-hmm. And I think that we just need to understand everything we can do to prevent this. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to ask you to talk a little bit more beyond just this one outbreak about the big picture for hepatitis C. You did it for HIV. Hepatitis C, tell us a little bit more about this in people who inject drugs in the country as a whole.
Sure. When we look at the burden of hepatitis C in the country, you know, we're talking about, it's about 3.5 million people who are living with
Much
hepatitis C.
Much bigger than HIV.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So,
right.
You know, and sometimes people are not aware of the burden of hepatitis C.
Mm-hmm.
But when we look at the population living with hepatitis C overall, the proportion that are actually aware of their diagnosis may be, you know, significantly lower. We saw that, you know, when we looked at the HIV population, about 15% are unaware of their diagnosis overall. When we look at hepatitis C, you know, we're talking closer to 50%.
50.
Exactly.
50% of people with hepatitis C may not know that they're infected.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, part of this has to do with just the indolent nature of the disease, the infection, you know, where there may not be any clinical manifestations, you know, for a very long time.
Right.
So people are, you know, living with hepatitis C, and, you know, unless they're offered testing, they may not become aware of the fact that they have hepatitis C. And then when we look at the trends and the epidemiology over the years, we saw that in, you know, looking at new cases, so the peak period was in the mid-90s, where we were seeing a lot of new cases. Mm. But then that steadily went down until very recently. So if we look at the bottom chart here, then we can see the trend from starting around 2010, we start to see a very steep increase that continues to go up to this day, which correlates directly with the opioid epidemic in
Interesting.
The US.
Right. So we had those baby boomer diagnoses kind of occurred. Those infections probably happened a decade or so earlier, diagnosed, then this, you know, decrease, and now we're seeing this upswing in a very different population driven by the opioid epidemic.
Mm-hmm.
Really remarkable. I think that's really important. And Jamie, we know that there's, we've talked about geographic differences, but also age differences, and there may be a confluence of these two as well, as highlighted in this map. I mean, what are you seeing? I mean, I think you also, just like we are, involved with the opioid epidemic, of course, of major proportions, and also involving young people.
Yeah, I mean, so as you mentioned, there's these geographic disparities, and really the map for hepatitis C overlaps very closely these, you know, concerning areas for HIV. People might be living with hepatitis C for a long time, and then we see these outbreaks of HIV that kind of come on the tail end of that. So whereas in sort of the West Coast is still the baby boomers that are predominantly the ones living with hepatitis C, in that area around Appalachia where we had the, you know, the HIV outbreaks that are these CDC HIV designated hotspots, though it's primarily hepatitis C is in the young adults. So we see, you know, that uptick is really manifesting in this particular area.
Right. It's not your grandma and grandpa's hepatitis C anymore.
No.
This is important because this helps us think about who we should be screening. And I think if we're thinking about baby boomers and we're not thinking about millennials and Gen Xers who may be at risk, especially in these hot spots, in these large hot regions, then I think we're going to miss it. So I think that's really, really key. So, Carlos, you mentioned this before, but, you know, the treatment cascade and thinking about hepatitis C like we do for HIV, that a lot of people don't know. You mentioned it, maybe half the people who are infected, that 3.5 million, don't even know it. And then what happens when even they get into care?
Right. And then, you know, we already start off, you know, at that point. And again, this may be better for people who inject drugs where they may have been tested, but then it rapidly drops off. So we see that the treatment cascade, you know, they don't get to the point of being referred for treatment or started on treatment. And so that once you get to the final bar here in the treatment cascade, the proportion of patients who have been treated and cured of hepatitis C is exceedingly low.
This is amazing. And these are, I mean, to be clear, these are a little bit older data, so maybe it's better now with some of the campaigns and the advertising and more availability. But even it was double, and it was 20% of people, that's still way too low. It means 80% of people walking around with hepatitis C or viremic and don't have, you know, benefit of getting a cure, which is what we have right now.
And hopefully we can skip that liver biopsy step as we work
through
our cascade.
Yeah, there was something I was put in there from before, but we don't exactly know. We're not endorsing liver biopsies.
Okay.
And so, Jamie, you know, when we look at the cascade for people who inject drugs, it is a little different.
It is a little different. So, again, we're seeing a lot more people diagnosed, but then really falling off in terms of getting assessed for treatment, actually started on treatment, and abysmally
low. Look at that SVR.
Just terrible.
It's almost as if, like, you don't achieve SVR, and people, you know, and these are more recent data. And I think the point of this article was that we need to do better, that there are these bottlenecks along the way. And the idea behind showing this is that it's not to say, oh, woe is us and look at how bad this is. It's to say, what can we do about it? And so can we do a better job of detection? Well, we're doing a pretty good job of detection. That's not where you want to spend that money. But maybe we could do a better job of linking people into care, getting them there and getting their testing done in an efficient way so that we can start treatment without delaying it, making it go on. 3 months of workup is not what you need to treat hepatitis C any longer, and then getting them in to get treated. And I think there's ways along the way that we can help facilitate this and catalyze it so people can get into care.
Absolutely.
So screening recommendations. We know that for HIV, they've been out there for a while. Hopefully they're starting to permeate and get a little bit further into the minds of providers, but we know that in primary care we're trying to get, you know, pretty much everyone at least tested once. Certainly those who are at higher risk, so people who live in populations where there may be, you know, 1% or more prevalence or have risk behaviors, we would like them to get tested more regularly, annually. Carlos, maybe go over a little bit for us the hepatitis C guidelines, because they're a little bit less clear, I think, to people, and they're being changed as we speak.
Right. So because of those trends that we saw earlier, in particularly for baby boomers, where we had, you know, a lot of the hepatitis C was really concentrated in that population, then the guidelines recommended one-time testing for all persons born between 1945 and 1965. Mm-hmm. So, you know, at least one-time testing, and that was clear, as well as, you know, a recommendation for screening of all people with risk behavior. So both people who use injection drugs, as well as those who use intranasal illicit drugs, because that, you know, as we know, is a form of transmission. So the United States Preventive Services Task Force actually, you know, is congruent in its recommendation, recommending then a testing of all baby boomers. But this is actually now changing, as we saw with the changing epidemiology of hepatitis C and the fact that we're seeing it now in younger adults, then there is now a new recommendation that is actually up for comments, but that will likely now become the official recommendation, which will then switch that to at least one-time testing for all adults, and that's recognizing that, you know, that there are people who are injecting drugs who are not just baby boomers, you know, who are younger adults, and also this will also help in that it will reduce the stigma that's attached to possibly, you know, to testing, to identifying somebody. If we offer testing to everybody, rather than just concentrating on, you know, well, this particular population, then, you know, we should be able to improve that 50% that bar that we saw where, you know, only about half are aware of their diagnosis.
Especially in those areas. I mean, it's universal is universal, and I get it, but especially in those areas where we're seeing on the maps, you know, if you're working in Appalachia, around Appalachia, Virginia, Ohio, North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee, I think that really even taking it even further to heart to do more general screening makes a lot of sense. That's really important. People often ask about how do we do screening and how do you interpret the test, and I think it's worthwhile going over this, even though I think a lot of people get it. With HIV testing, there's been an evolution in the tests, and so I think that has caused some confusion over the years for those of us who've been around long enough to see some of these tests. Right now, we're basically almost all trying to use what we call the combo or architect or duo test. And this is a test that has sort of a sandwich, right, of two different components. One is looking for the antibody to HIV, which is what standard testing has done for, you know, two decades, but also looking for an antigen, a protein that's in the virus called P24, and that's expressed early on during infection. So with this test, you can look really soon after infection and detect the presence of the component, the protein component, the P24, and then later on, the antibody. Mm-hmm. So the window period for this test is about 10 days, meaning if someone was infected, you know, 11 days ago, this test should be able to pick up that that person was infected. So let's go through it real quick. And certainly if you get this test and it's negative, that's really great. And it means that unless that person had a risk activity a day or two or three ago, this person is, for all intents and purposes, HIV negative. Mm-hmm. The unhappy path, of course, is if the person's positive. This test comes back positive. And part of the problem with this test is it doesn't tell you which component was positive. It just gives you positive or negative. It doesn't tell you antibody or protein. Mm-hmm. So we have to do a little bit of sleuthing. And so the way to do that is then you would do straight out antibody testing as a supplement. And if you do antibody testing, you can get one of a few different results, right? So you do antibody tests for HIV-1 and HIV-2, and the HIV antibody test shows positive. Well, lo and behold, that's what the combo test was picking up. It was picking up antibody. This person's been infected for some time, 3 or 4 weeks or more, 3 years, 13 years, mm-hmm. we don't know. But antibody's present, this person's chronically infected, not acutely infected. Mm-hmm. Got it, okay? Same thing if antibody's to HIV-2, it's rarer, West Africa, Caribbean, same idea. Certainly people can get infected with both, pretty unusual, but I've seen it a couple of times. What happens, though, if the antibody's negative? And this is why this test was designed. So if you do antibody testing, you get an indeterminate or negative result for HIV-1 or 2 antibodies, you really have to start thinking the test was picking up the protein alone. Mm. This is picking up virus before the body's made antibodies, and this is acute infection. And you can document this and confirm it by looking for nucleic acids to the genes of the virus. Mm-hmm. And to do that, you can do a NAT or RNA test. If that's negative, well, then this test is completely negative. It was picking up some false positive. Maybe retesting in a couple of weeks would make sense. But in most cases, what you're going to see is that the NAT or the RNA is positive and this person has acute HIV infection. Mm-hmm. So it's a little complicated. You have to go down the algorithm and think it out. But really, we're just trying to figure out which of the components were positive so you can figure out is this chronic infection or is this acute infection. For hepatitis C antibody testing, it's even a little simpler. Mm-hmm. And I think that's great with a couple of things kicked in. Get the antibody test and it's negative. You pretty much feel really good about that. The only thing would be if they did have some activity where they're in that window period. And the window period for the HIV, the hepatitis C antibody test is longer. It could be weeks after someone shoots and gets hepatitis C exposure and gets infected before antibodies. So you really want to take a good history, as we would with the HIV testing, and find out, does this person have any risk factors or any evidence? Now, what if it's positive? Well, then you'd want to know, do they have productive infection? Do they have viremia? Because about 20 to 30% of people who are infected with hepatitis C clear it all by themselves. So my patients are shocked when they hear that. They had no idea. They thought that once you're hepatitis C positive, you're hepatitis C positive means you got an infection. But we do know that maybe only 80% of people go on and have chronic infection, 20 clear it by themselves. So you want to figure out, is your patient one of those 20% or not? Mm-hmm. And if you get RNA testing and there's no RNA there, but they have a reactive antibody, they've cleared the infection. But if they do have RNA, then you have to think about, this is a person who's infected, go down the stream, do the appropriate linkage to care.
Yeah, and I think it's important for people to know that once you have a reactive hep C antibody, you always have it.
Exactly.
So even if you spontaneously clear your RNA, even if you're treated and you have SVR, you will always have that positive
And that
antibody.
Can be a source of confusion for patients
because,
you know, they're
labeled.
Right. They're told, well, you know, you've cleared the infection, and yet, you know, if anybody else does another hep C antibody test, it will be positive.
It's really hard to explain it, but once you do, because I say it's like mumps, measles, you had it when you were a kid, varicella, you're going to always have evidence of that because your body made a reaction. Mm-hmm. Your body made a reaction. The footprints are there, but it's gone. It just left the footprints. You don't have to worry about the virus itself. Mm-hmm. Same thing happens when we cure you. Your antibody will always be there,
right.
But it'll be the virus will be gone.
And the electronic health record will haunt you forever.
It's going to be on your problem list, just like hepatitis B or hepatitis. Once you're positive, everyone says you're positive, but you're not positive. Yeah.
But along with that, I think another important point to make is that the fact that you have antibody but no hepatitis C RNA, so while you don't have active infection, it does not mean that you're immune against hepatitis.
Right.
And that you
it's
may,
not
in fact,
not a protective antibody.
Exactly.
It's
you could become reinfected.
If it was, we'd have a vaccine. Mm-hmm. So we talk about, you know, screening, and I think one thing I wanted to insert there just as, you know, a soapbox thing is that, you know, in the correctional system, which is some of the settings we talked about, I think the VA does a fantastic job of screening, and they have electronic medical record reminders and things like that. In the correctional system, it's much more disparate, and I think we just have to recognize that this is an opportunity, given mass incarceration and the bad mm-hmm. things about it. One thing that we could do is piggyback some screening on top of that. And so we do know from older data that may be representative still things that are happening today. Of all the people living with HIV in the country, maybe about 15-20% pass through jail or prison every year. Mm-hmm. So again, if some proportion of those are people who don't know that they're infected, this is an opportunity to identify them and then get them into care. It's much worse for hepatitis C. Given who we lock up nowadays, a disproportionate number of people who are incarcerated, either in prison or jail, have hepatitis C infection. And as we talked about, a lot don't know it. So this is another opportunity. So we should be thinking about in our correctional systems. Similarly, TB. And I think there is a lot of screening for TB because prisons don't want to have their healthcare workers and their correctional officers or anybody else get infected because it's communicable by air. So there's a lot of impetus for screening for that. Less so for hepatitis C and somewhat for HIV. This is a really, really horrible slide, but it shows you that a lot of prison systems, state prison systems, have mandatory or opt-out testing for HIV. They take it very seriously, even some right before release. So we're doing a lot of screening for HIV, much less so for hepatitis C. And it's really spotty, and it may be that there's a financial disincentive, because if you find 40% of your 50,000 people who are in your prison system have hepatitis C, how are you going to treat it? But I do think there's opportunities, and for those of us in the audience who have any sort of say in what's going on at a local level in jails or prisons, we should try to think about incorporating more screening for HIV, hepatitis C as appropriate.
And linkage to care.
Always has to be followed by linkage to care, which is a real challenge in
the
post-correctional landscape, but I think everything we could do, and many people are working hard on this, and many different places have different systems in place, but I do think. So other interventions, besides taking advantage of some of the opportunities of when people pass through different institutions or in healthcare settings, ERs we didn't talk about, but that's another opportunity. Other things, Carlos, that you've heard about or know about that could help?
Sure, and convenience to provide screening is the key, and I think particularly because when we're talking about these populations that of interest, so people who inject drugs, for many of them, they don't have regular access to healthcare, so they may not have a primary care provider that they can talk to, and then who may then want to test them for HIV or hepatitis C, but they do come into contact with the healthcare system in different ways. So as you mentioned, either through urgent care or emergency departments, there are some innovative programs, for example, through community pharmacies, where offering hepatitis C testing or an HIV point of care testing, and then linkage to care from the community pharmacies.
That would be fantastic,
right? And particularly when we think about where we have our community pharmacies, widely distributed, so they're much more accessible. Mm-hmm. For example, for patients living in rural areas, as opposed to the medical centers that may be several hours away. So it's important to think about how we can then incorporate testing and then establish partnerships to facilitate linkage to care, so that then we can make that process smoother and more convenient for the patients.
Yeah, it's amazing to me that after one of the companies started advertising on TV about hepatitis C therapy, how many people came in. So I do think that there's some role as well for a lot of this active work, but also passively. So for those people who are listening to us today, in your waiting rooms, it's okay to have posters that say, get, hepatitis C screened. Hepatitis C is 3.5 million people, whatever you need. There's so many good materials out there. You want your patient to come in and say, I saw that, or I heard about this. Have you tested me for this? that helps augment all the activities that I think we're doing here with point-of-care testing involving pharmacies. But I do think having them know about this as well, and we've done this with HIV, I think we could do with hepatitis C, but I think this is sort of marching orders to everyone's listening that, again, incorporating this, keeping this in your mind, not having this be an afterthought. It's too late when someone comes in and has cirrhosis to figure out that they have hepatitis C.
Right, and considering the tools that we now have, considering the fact that the treatments are now so effective and so well tolerated, and also for particularly now for hepatitis C, I mean, we can cure hepatitis C in 8 to 12 weeks.
Right.
You know, there's really no reason why we should be deferring treatment. We really need to be offering it more.
Right, and there's a lot of different studies as we wrap up this section that demonstrate the missed opportunities. There's a cottage industry of literature of people who pass through EDs or people who pass through STI clinics or people who, you know, went to medical visits, primary care visits, and subsequently we were able to look back and see, well, they were HIV infected or they were hepatitis C infected and nobody knew about it. And so I think we really do, primary care has a lot on its plate. They only have 8 minutes to see a patient and do everything from seatbelts to antidepressants to blood pressure. But incorporating this in ways that make sense, and I think some of the things that you mentioned here really do help share the burden are great. And I think we have to do more of that. So screening up, trying to get more people into care, understanding more about this, partnering, as you said, with you know, likely partners, pharmacies and others, and really concentrating on the areas that are the hot spots, I think, are some of the take-home messages that I heard, given where we're seeing both of these infections occur and the role of opioids and the injection drug use issue that we're dealing with in this country so hard. Wonderful. Great. So I think what we'll do is now move on to our second objective. Okay, so this is also interesting. Here what we're trying to do is really apply some of the evidence-based treatment approaches in patients with OUD, with HIV and hepatitis C, or even in co-infection. So this gets a little bit more from screening to thinking a little bit more about management and treatment, including the right setting for doing that. Okay. To set the stage, I'm going to share with you a case, though, kind of get this, get our brains thinking a little bit about this in a clinical way. So Justine's 39, and she's a woman who presented for both co-infection care following a five-month prison stay in a state prison system. She came in, as is unfortunately the case, at least she had something, but she had an envelope with one page of a handwritten referral that said, you know, HIV positive, hepatitis C, antibody positive, and not much else. A list of some of her medicines. Justine herself was able to tell us that she was diagnosed in 2007 with HIV. She had entered a residential treatment program, and they did a great job of screening folks, and at that time she had a heroin addiction that she was seeking care for. Since that time, she's had some on and off periods, spells for her ART, was off when she entered prison, but they have a good program, and they started her on HIV therapy. We don't know a whole lot about it, but we know she's on darunavir, cobicistat, plus TAF-FTC. She reports that since she's been out of prison, which has been about a month, she's been taking it every day. And she said while she was in prison, she was taking it and she got undetectable. She says her prior treatment was just a single pill that she took before bed that made her have weird dreams. I think we could figure that out. She said that she had ALT and AST abnormalities, which she said was her liver tests were abnormal, and that they did a test for hepatitis C, and they said that she was hepatitis C positive and she should seek care, and that's why she's with us today. Since she's been released, she's been living with an ex-boyfriend, but that's a temporary situation. She uses heroin, still not as much as she did before, but she's used a few times since she's been out. She does use clean needles. She says she only uses clean needles, and her boyfriend gets it from a harm reduction station that he shares with her. There's no illicit drugs or alcohol other than what we've talked about. So I did some labs, of course, at that visit, and the good news is that her viral load for HIV is undetectable. Her T-cell count is pretty robust at over 400. Safety labs do confirm she has a transaminitis, and her hepatitis C RNA that I was able to get from the lab to do, even though I didn't have an antibody test on hand, was 256,000. And she had genotype 1, and I did a fibrosis score, and it was F2, so she doesn't have cirrhosis. Hepatitis B surface antibody is positive, so she's immune. She doesn't have hepatitis B. She's immune for hepatitis B. The cavalry came over the hill. That's a protective antibody. Other than that, really not much to report. Her STI screening was negative. RPR is negative, and she has a low HDL, but nothing else. We do a PHQ-9 depression screener, and she scored pretty high. and that's not uncommon as well. She's not on an antidepressant, and that's something we can address. And she says she's interested in substance use counseling. She would like to not use heroin. Social work has been involved. We get them involved in cases all the time, and they say that we really don't have great residential treatment for her right now available, and only a shelter would be really for her. We fill out paperwork to get her some services, including medical Uber and medications and some referrals to a food bank. But, you know, this is the problem. You know, what do we do? And so I'm going to ask the audience, you know, what they would do, and then we can talk a little bit more. So based on current guidelines, given that Justine's HIV infected, she's got hepatitis C that seems like it's really newly diagnosed, you know, type 1A, no cirrhosis, what would you think would be the best approach based upon the clinical guidelines? A, wait until she enters a recovery program. B, wait until she's abstinent from substances for 6 months to start hepatitis C therapy. C, start hepatitis C therapy now. Or D, really it's just best that I don't deal with this and let's send her to a hepatologist and let them manage her. Mm-hmm. So we'll come back to this later on. So I think for us as infectious disease providers who don't like people having untreated infections, there's no debate that she needs to stay on her HIV therapy, and there may be ways we could talk, you know, amongst ourselves about simplifying her HIV regimen or changing it in some way or another. Mm-hmm. But doesn't matter, she should be on HIV therapy, and she is, and that's great. But what about her hepatitis C? And that's the problem. And so, Carlos, if we do go back to those guidelines, we ask the audience, based upon guidelines, what would be the best approach? What would the guidelines say we should do for Justine?
Right, and I think it's very important that we highlight and we understand, you know, what the guidelines recommend, you know, what the science points to, right, as opposed to what we may hear or sometimes, you know, what we may be restricted in doing because of limitations from our own Medicaid plans in our states. So the guidelines actually recommend treatment for all people with active hepatitis C, chronic hepatitis C. Mm. So, and this includes those who may be using injection drugs.
So it doesn't matter fibrosis score.
No.
Doesn't matter. And if, even if you're using drugs,
right,
the guidelines say we should treat hepatitis C. Mm-hmm.
Right. And then, you know, the what had evolved is that you may want to prioritize, obviously, patients with more advanced liver disease, well, those who have cirrhosis or F4 fibrosis. However, you know, the recommendation is to treat everybody who has hepatitis C. And there is no contraindication for those patients who may be using drugs, who may have a history of drug use or who may be using drugs currently. Because in fact, when we look at the data, we see that, you know, with the current direct-acting antiviral options that we have that are so effective, mm-hmm, and so well tolerated, that even patients who are still using drugs, you know, as is the case of this patient, they are very likely to do well with treatment. And in fact, you know, the vast majority of them are able to achieve completion of treatment and achieve SVR12, and they are cured of hepatitis C. That is, I think, an important point. And this sometimes, you know, there's some confusion about this. Another concern may be, well, you know, if the patient continues to use drugs,
right,
or you know, they haven't abstained from drugs for a long period of time, then what about reinfection? You know, then
right.
So are we just wasting,
right,
you know, the time by treating them if they're going to get reinfected? And when we look at the data, we actually see that the reinfection rate for people who inject drugs is actually pretty low.
Really?
So
it is pretty low.
You know, then it still points to the fact that, you know, it is beneficial to treat patients. And even for when we think about the fact that even if somebody does become reinfected, you know, we will be able to treat, and we don't necessarily burn through our options, it does not mean that treatment will not work the next time.
Right, either. And Jamie, like, think about this. So, like, it's sort of a circular argument, because if we don't treat, then there's more circulating virus, there's more community viral load.
Yes.
If we do treat and we lower that person's viral load, or at least some of those people's viral load, there's less virus in the community to be there to reinfect someone and allow them to get reinfected. So if you're worried about reinfection, then really you can make an argument, then that's why we should be treating more.
Exactly.
Because it's, even in the prison system, we talk about transmission of HIV, but if most people in prison, in a prison system, have an undetectable viral load, then it doesn't, it's not as much of a concern. It's not as much of an operative force. So I think, again, the data are proving this, and I'm glad that the guidelines are reinforcing this. I mean, I see this as being really an imperative for public health, that we shouldn't stand on ceremony. And there's pretty good data that people can get on therapy and stay, even while they use substances. And it's short-course therapy.
Right. And ideally, we'd, you know, wrap it around with harm reduction services and wrap it around with treatment for her substance use disorders just in general, but also because it's treatment as prevention for transmission of her hep C. But we can certainly easily get her cured of her hep C. Why wouldn't we?
Yeah. So, interestingly, from our survey, 70% of our respondents agreed that they would treat her now with hepatitis C therapies. So I think that's great, and I think that that is exactly the right thing to do. That's not to say at all costs, and I think we're pragmatic here. We know that if someone has much more chaos in their lives, if there's a problem with being able to come back to clinic. I have one person I've been working with very hard who's in and out of recovery programs where sometimes he could take pills with him, sometimes he can't take pills with him. That guy, we're trying to work on what's the right timing. And but for most people, just like HIV therapy, I think this is analogous. If people will take their medicine, you have a relatively reasonable assumption that they will and they're committed to doing it, we should try. And here it's 8 weeks maybe.
And if you're waiting for your perfect moment to come to start treatment, it's not going to happen. So do the best you can and support people's adherence through it.
What's also nice is that we have really good medicines, and I think that's changed everything. These are game changers, and there's even pangenotympic medicines that you've talked about. They play well pretty much with most HIV therapies, as we'll show you in the next slide. So again, shorter course therapies, minimal testing. We're starting to play a lot now in some of our facilities, mental health and substance use facilities, with just treating people while they're there, and to save costs, really not even doing a genotype if we're going to use a pangenotypic, you know, regimen, and doing minimal touch because it's so safe, we could do minimal touch type things.
Right, and now, you know, because these are treatments that are so effective, we're looking at, you know, their cure rates that are 95% plus, you know, so it's almost a guarantee. Once you start somebody on treatment, when you get them to that point, you will most likely cure their hepatitis C. So with such effective treatments that are so well tolerated, and now with such, you know, much shorter courses, then the this doesn't have to be prescribed by a specialist anymore.
You know, primary care people can do this.
Exactly. It's something that has been shown. You know, there's several demonstration projects around the country that have shown that, you know, primary care, this can be done in primary care clinics. Now, there are some restrictions, you know, still, but that don't reflect the science. In some states, like, for example, in my state, the requirement is still for a specialist to prescribe treatment. But if we're thinking about how do we get treatment to those patients who may live in rural areas, who may not have the ability to get to a specialty clinic so easily, then, you know, we really need to consider and bring it down to being able to provide treatment from primary care providers.
Right. So bottlenecks that are structural as well that we have to battle. You mentioned it before, I just wanted to highlight again, you know, there's some bidirectional benefits, right, for hepatitis C therapy and HIV therapy in co-infected people.
Right, yeah, we know that people who have hepatitis C and HIV co-infection, their HIV can progress faster potentially, their hepatitis C can progress faster to end-stage liver disease and associated morbidity, mortality, so all the more reason to treat both.
And
thankfully with hep C, we have a cure,
So this comes up a lot. People say, but what about the drug interactions? And this really was a problem just a few short years ago, and I think we had some problems with some of our boosters. And TDF, but we're learning that, you know, more and more we're using medications that don't have boosters, that we can use them, they're potent, they have high barriers to resistance, and it's a new era. So I like this chart because really you don't have to look at the words, you just have to look at the colors. And green means okay, you're good to go. And for the newer regimens, and we gave you a whole, you know, palette of different hepatitis C therapies, there's lots of options here. And it's very rare nowadays, I have to say, that I have to change someone's HIV therapy to accommodate their hepatitis C therapy.
Right.
Right. I mean, unless they're the rare case that they're on a boosted integrase inhibitor, other than that, you've got fields wide open.
And even with other drugs, because the treatment courses are now much shorter, so for example, restrictions and interactions with like PPIs or anticonvulsants or statins, you may be able to hold the statin for 8 weeks while you cure the hepatitis C, and before restarting. Same thing with the PPIs, for example. Or you may, you may have other options. So it's really, there are very, I can't think really of any cases now where we are unable to treat the hepatitis
right.
C.
Right. Right. Yeah. And we have so many more choices. Mm-hmm. I think for Justine's case, this was also important for me to think about, which is getting a team-based approach and using different components, trying to bundle her care, I think, as Jamie talked about, and have much of this co-located, getting syringe exchange programs. She's already hooked up with Clean Needles, but keeping that independent of her all these things that we needed to bring to bear. And so one thing that came up for me was, I have my priorities and we've listed them, keeping her HIV under control, her hepatitis C, getting it under control, all these other things. I could work on her depression, I could work on her HDL, all these things. But for her, it was like, I need money and I need to find a place to live because he's driving me crazy. Mm-hmm. And, I have no transportation. I'm dependent upon others. And you know what? My teeth. I'm embarrassed to smile. Mm-hmm. These are really important to her. And I think everyone in the audience understands this, but I do think thinking about it strategically, I get her to see a dentist. Believe it or not, that could have a big impact on whether or not she completes her hepatitis C therapy. Mm-hmm. So we might say, oh, this person injects drugs, this person isn't reliable. But if we do the right thing, if we plant the seed in the right soil and nurture it the right way, we will have growth. I think there's these things that we don't learn in textbooks that could really make a big difference too. And they're not evidence-based, but I think they're pragmatic and logical. And even buprenorphine treatment, and I think this is really important. In New Haven and other places, they really spent a lot of time thinking about MAT and how even co-locating MAT can help hepatitis C adherence.
I mean, absolutely. It would be great to give people one-stop shopping, right? As opposed to having to go around to all these different providers. So I think this data really shows that people who are sustained on buprenorphine treatment for at least 6 months are more likely to get into Hep C care and get treated and everything else. I mean, drug treatment is stabilizing for lots of reasons. This shows here it's stabilizing and then it gets people into care.
And it gets people into care and it's a hook that we could use.
That's right.
These are really interesting data that as we end up this section I just wanted to go over because this is from, it's hard to find great data about barriers to care. And this is regional, this is in Seattle, but it's looking at folks who came into this care system and had barriers to getting their HIV care. And a lot of what people reported were structural. And again, this is something that's a little bit out of their control, right? A lot out of their control, not having insurance, trouble getting to appointments, no transportation. There were at least one healthcare organization barrier as well, which is like homelessness and using drugs and, didn't feel like they need to see a doctor. Mm-hmm. We also know that patient satisfaction matters a lot when we talk about, the provider experience, with the patient or the clinic experience overall. People who are more satisfied with their clinics, if you're nicer to them, and not just the people in the white coats, but people at the front desk, the people who answer the phone, this makes a difference. And again, this sounds touchy-feely, but it can be very impactful when you see that people say, I don't go back to that clinic because I don't like the way that they treated me. I have patients that I refer to specialists who will not go back to that specialist because they didn't like the way. So same thing can happen to us in our clinics. And again, it's a front desk all the way through to the back exam room that we really need to be thoughtful about. How do we create cultures, environments where people are accepted, whether or not they're men or sex with men, people who inject drugs, trans, whatever person comes into our door, they should feel welcomed and accepted and know that they matter. And when we transmit that to people, the likelihood of them coming back is much higher. And I think that's really an important point that we sometimes miss. Other things that I've read about and that you guys know about too are things like this data to care. This in principle makes a lot of sense, and there's some places that are doing it better than others, but there's a lot of big data, right? So people in the state, the departments of health, they know oftentimes who's getting viral load tested and what CD4 cell counts are being reported. And we're trying to work on ways, and others have too, where if you see a viral load done 2 to 3 times a year and all of a sudden it's not being done in that person, are they out of care? And having strategies to find those people. This is a pretty potent model, and people are working on it. You know, different states have different approaches. Also biological approaches, right? Mm-hmm. So we're going to see changes in therapeutics, both for HIV and hepatitis C, that may make it even easier to keep people on medicines, get the outcomes that we're caring about, right? It's almost taking a page a little bit out of contraception.
Yeah, I mean, all of the first-line HIV regimens now are single tablet regimens, right, once daily, that are relatively easy to tolerate. But the idea, you know, coming down the pipeline of long-acting injectables right. that really overcome that adherence challenge, especially for people who inject drugs, can be such a problem.
Yeah, and even with hepatitis C, I wouldn't yes. be surprised if we start to still see some innovation or even shorter course therapies.
Right.
Mm.
Yeah, there are actually several trials now looking at courses of 6 weeks and even 4 weeks. And, you know, we're looking at treating, acute hepatitis C with shorter courses as well. So,
right.
Right. A lot of exciting developments.
Mm-hmm. Well, this has been great. Okay. Well, let's go on to our third and last learning objective. Mm-hmm. And this is identifying patients with OUD at high risk for HIV infection who are candidates for HIV prevention strategies, mm-hmm. including especially for PrEP. Mm-hmm. So, Jamie, there's a lot of tools in the toolbox when we talk mm-hmm. about HIV prevention. How about for people who inject drugs?
Yeah, again, a lot of tools in the toolbox, a lot of highly effective evidence-based strategies to reduce the risk of HIV among people who inject drugs. As we mentioned, they're kind of a key target population in the HIV epidemic. So one, I'll start at the bottom, is sort of the treatment for substance use disorders. We mentioned the buprenorphine piece, but medication-assisted therapy for opioid use disorders really is effective HIV prevention. Mm. If people are getting their opioid yeah. use disorder treated and they're not injecting, they're much less likely to acquire HIV. We already talked about sort of the importance of HIV testing, hepatitis C, and sexually transmitted infection testing. Importantly, the tests turn out positive, we got a link to care.
Right.
And that is also a prevention strategy. Syringe service programs. So I say syringe service, not syringe exchange, right. Rarely recognizing that it's not just needles and syringes, it's all of the equipment that goes along with it that can be really important. We need to acknowledge that people who inject drugs, experience sexual risk too.
Right.
They might have overlapping risk networks, especially true for women who often have sex with the people that they're injecting with. So even though condoms are imperfect and require negotiation and there's partner dynamics, they are still an effective, barrier prevention method. And within that, we fit in HIV pre-exposure and post-exposure prophylaxis as sort of using antiretrovirals for people who are HIV negative but at high risk of acquiring infection.
Right, right. Makes sense. So there's more than just condoms out there.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's
the take-home message. We're
yes.
not going to condomize our way out of this epidemic.
No.
And so we talked about the continuum or the cascade before.
Yeah.
You're a big proponent for thinking about the cascade before the cascade.
There's a left side to that continuum, right?
Right?
So we talked about if people HIV test positive, right, they're going down the route of needing to be engaged in care and started on treatment. Mm-hmm. However, if they test negative, they need to be aware of the fact that they're at risk for HIV. Many people
right.
don't. Aware that there's something out there that's PrEP, and it's a highly effective HIV prevention strategy that might be right for them. Then link to PrEP care, actually started on it, and being retained on it or adhering to it. PrEP only works if you take it. So if you want to stay on the left side of that cascade, right, you have to get on PrEP and stay
yeah,
on
I like sort of these algorithms where they say, well, you do the test, and no matter what right. result you get, there's actions that are taken. You get an HIV test, for instance, and it's negative. Well, then you can start talking about risk reduction
yes.
and PrEP maybe if it's positive, getting on treatment, linking to care, that kind of thing.
Yes.
Same thing for hepatitis C. So I do think that there's no sort of like useless or result that you don't do anything about. Even a negative result is actionable, especially with prevention being as readily available as we see here with HIV.
Yeah, and we see good evidence from cities like New York City where they have implemented this and by then being able to link people who are HIV infected to care and then keeping them virally suppressed, or people who are at risk, you know, and test negative for HIV, but, you know, starting them on PrEP, then that has resulted in a significant decrease in the incidence of HIV, and we see this right. in several different communities. So it is important that, you know, that we start to think about how that may apply to our own communities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is going to be important because we're going to talk about for the rest of this time a lot about PrEP, and we could talk all day about PrEP, some of us, because we're sort of evangelical about it, but I think the benefits are clearly there. So according to the CDC, there are some recommendations for who PrEP might be available for, and I'm going to ask Jamie again to kind of walk us through that. Who is listed as a good candidate for PrEP?
Yeah, and this slide looks complicated, but actually it's pretty straightforward. So the CDC says that adults or adolescents more than 35 kilos who do not have HIV and engage in some sort of risky behavior are good candidates for PrEP. So people who inject drugs might experience HIV risk related to their injection drug use, right? They might be injecting and sharing either syringes, needles, or other drug preparation equipment. It's important to ask about the equipment.
Right.
Or they might be people who are on medication-assisted treatment, which oddly enough is considered being at high risk for relapse.
Right.
So by that criteria, they would meet
PrEP. This is really key mm-hmm. because I think even those people in the audience who know about PrEP probably think of it for sexual transmission interruption,
right.
but it can be effective, as we know, for people who inject drugs, and we have some data to provide that
Great.
For us. We know that this works really well for sexual transmission, but good data as well that almost same sort of numbers for people who inject drugs. Very effective. There's not a question of efficacy. We also know that if you take the drug, and you said it before, it works better than if you don't take
That's
the
right.
drug. And we know this for men, and we know this for women, and we certainly know that among high adherers, we're talking about like 90% plus.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of people who the CDC say meet the criteria you just went over. And this gets some of these numbers again, 1.1 million people who could be eligible for PrEP based upon typical sorts of risk factors
mm-hmm.
that they've come up with. And I think that's even conservative. And of those, maybe about 100,000 are people who inject drugs. Yet only a fraction of people who inject drugs are really on that right now. If you look at it, you know, we don't even know. We don't even
can't
have
even
good
find
data
because
it's not something pharmacies or market data people collect. We know a little bit about women who are getting in, it's underrepresented, but still there. We know African-American people of color underrepresented. We know in the South we see the same thing. So we have a whole bunch of people who are indicated for PrEP, a whole bunch of people who are not getting PrEP, and I would argue strenuously that probably a lot of people who inject drugs don't even know about PrEP, not offered PrEP. And this is really, I think, a place for a lot of movement, and we've got to start thinking more about it.
Mm-hmm.
So we talk a little bit about not only continuum sort of like in the steps that we've talked about, but the continuum in getting people into care and keeping people in care. And we only have a few minutes left, so I want to make sure we cover this and some of the mechanics of how to get PrEP going. But
sure.
anything you want to highlight sort of on this continuum and the key challenges in overcoming them?
Yeah, I just think the biggest is that many people who inject drugs don't even realize they're at risk for HIV.
Right.
They certainly feel so stigmatized and shamed in most healthcare settings, and there's a real lack of mistrust that they're not going to easily disclose their injection drug use, even if you try to take a really good history. So I think, you know, that is just a barrier that we need to overcome if we're going to engage people in services.
Yeah, you're exactly right. So this, you know, the behavioral surveillance system found that a lot of folks who have a PrEP indication who inject drugs had never heard of it. So
right.
this is not who we're advertising to. This is not how we're making messaging happen. So I think this is a real area. And we've seen even in the VA system, which is a really good system, you know, low uptakes of PrEP. And I think this points to a global problem. And your own data right as well, so there's a gap in knowledge and understanding. And then I think we have to be careful. There's a lot of people who hear about it and don't want to use it. I don't
right.
want to take a pill. It's medicalized. So it's not just, you know, the supply side. It's the demand side, too. And I think understanding that there's things we could do to make PrEP more acceptable to people, maybe,
yes.
again, co-locating with other things, like we talked about, other medications and other services are important. And, Carlos, you mentioned this, and I think this is really key. In areas where we see higher uptake of PrEP, we're seeing decrease rates of new diagnoses. So this is a really nice analysis. I've looked at a bunch of different states that report their data, both these kinds of data, and you can see that where we saw, you know, low uptake of PrEP, we actually saw some increases in aging. This is, you know, correlation, not necessarily causation, but I think we can make that leap pretty clearly.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, the bottom line is prep works.
Right.
If, you know, and considering that we can be doing much better. So given that we have the examples of the communities where it is, the uptake is higher, then, you know, it's, I think it falls on all of us to really make it available as much as possible.
Yeah, and I think places that do a better job. And, you know, there's a bunch of different strategies that are out there. There's different settings that we've talked about. Mm-hmm. There's different approaches like rapid start or same day start. All these things are available. All these things are being studied. And I think that this, that there's a lot of work going on with PrEP. This is what the CDC uses for their risk indicator, and this is what they generate some of their data from. So I think this is helpful, and it can be used clinically as well. And people who want to, you know, fill this out with a patient can. Let's go through really just quickly. This is like everything you need to know about starting people on PrEP in like 30 seconds. But the key thing, and we've harped on this before, is that PrEP is for people who don't have HIV. So you have to do everything you can in your power to make sure that this person is not HIV infected. Okay, and the combo test can do that, along with a history and looking for signs or symptoms of acute HIV. So if you're convinced pretty much this person doesn't have something that happened the night before, and you know, you get this test and it's negative, this person's good to go for PrEP. Doesn't take a lot. Let's make it really clear. So you get your HIV test, okay, and you should use the combo test, that's preferred. And then you get maybe a creatinine just to make sure that, you know, you're still within the bounds of the indication, a creatinine clearance of 50 or greater, right, for TDF, FTC. Don't have to get a Chem-68, could just be a 1 creatinine if you want to order it that way, and you calculate the creatinine clearance on your phone. And then, you know, you got to do some viral hepatitis studies. And really the key one, I would say, is just making sure the person's not chronically infected with hepatitis B. We'll get into hepatitis B testing right now, but you want to make sure they're not chronically infected. If they are, you can still use PrEP.
Right.
Perfectly fine. Just realize now you're treating hepatitis B, because TDF and FTC both have activity, and TAF as well, against hepatitis B, and TAF will probably be available soon for treating, as PrEP. So I think just being aware of that, even if the person joins a monastery, no longer has any risk behaviors whatsoever of acquiring HIV, you'd keep them on the medicines to suppress their hepatitis B.
I think, too, that when you get to the viral hepatitis question, that you can think about PrEP as a gateway to other care, right?
Absolutely.
So if all of a sudden we flag, hey, this person's not Hep B immune, now we have an opportunity to vaccinate to educate, right? Or if they do have chronic Hep B, now we have an opportunity to treat. So
right, and
PrEP
then
is a,
you know,
gateway.
We are seeing them frequently, so every 3 months. So then we get to address the other issues,
yes,
that, you know, may be going on in their lives. So I think it's a great opportunity to engage them in care and keep
absolutely
them in care.
Absolutely. Question that comes up a lot is how long before a person starts PrEP before, mm-hmm, you can say you're good to go. And we know that there are some differences based upon what kind of sexual practices and what and who you are. So we know that rectal penetration of the active metabolites of the drug are present within 7 days in the rectal tissue. And we don't know if that's the exact correlate of protection, but it's a reasonable one to assume, probably fairly conservative. We know that it may take longer to get concentrations in the blood. So for people who inject drugs, we may not say that if you start on TDF-FTC and you can inject tomorrow or the next day, it may take a couple of weeks or more.
Mm-hmm.
Cervical-vaginal, we know as well, also maybe around 2 to 3 weeks before we get concentrations where we can say we feel that there's enough drug present. Now, it may be less, and it may be that there's other mechanisms by which there's protection, but I think these are good sort of ballpark figures to use when counseling people.
Yeah, you need to let them manage their expectations. It's
right.
Not you start on a magic pill and day
right.
one you're good to go. You really need to think about actually probably using condoms and other mechanisms in that package. That's why PrEP has to be part of the package deal.
Right, right. Good. And then we mentioned it a couple of times just on the side, same day initiation of PrEP. This is kind of catching on, and I think it plays into this, well, why would I wait to get this kind of thing? Any
yeah.
experience with this or thoughts?
Yeah, so this is kind of a hot topic. It's sort of a cool idea. This is a study shown here from an STD clinic in the Denver metropolitan area where they basically screened all comers, 500 people within a, you know, certain frame for whether or not they had PrEP eligibility. Everyone met with the patient navigator on site, you know, that mm-hmm. day to help with eligibility benefits and insurance. They had a pharmacist on site that delivered them a 30-day starter packet right there,
right.
And showed that actually 78% ultimately, or 78 individuals ultimately, well, about 78%,
yeah.
Ultimately followed through within 28 days of seeing a PrEP provider.
Yeah.
So this was all MSM. This is 100% non-Hispanic white. You know, wait to see how it gets borne out among people who inject
yeah,
drugs.
Rapid Start has this balance, and I think it sends a signal that this is urgent, where right. you don't have to wait, you don't have to procrastinate, you know, there's no, like, well, loss to follow-up. You do it, and I think it is a hook that brings people back if they get a medication as well, and we're seeing that with HIV therapy.
Right, and it allows us to, you know, then use those windows of opportunity at the
yes.
time when, you know, the patient is paying attention, the person realizes, okay, I'm having that discussion about risk, so this is the time when maybe this is right for me, and maybe I should go on PrEP, and it's being offered right now, so I can go ahead. And considering the, you know, the rate of no-shows that we see for those initial PrEP visits in our clinics, where somebody may be referred, but then they're seen, you know, a month,
right.
they're supposed to be seen a month later, and by then, you know, that window of opportunity may be gone, or that suddenly it's no longer as high a priority for that patient.
Right, anything could happen, right? Mm-hmm. So this is, as our wrap-up, you know, in quality assurance, we talk about our SMART goals, you know, things that are specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely. And I think I've heard a bunch of these today, and I think they're important. So implement strategies to improve HIV and hepatitis C testing within clinical workflow. People should be thinking to themselves, how do I do that? I'm doing it. How do I do it better?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's number one. Two, apply guideline recommendations to optimize HIV and hepatitis C treatment. We are very fortunate to have guidelines that are thoughtful, well-written, and up-to-date in HIV and hepatitis C.
Mm-hmm.
Not every disease state has that,
mm-hmm.
and people are left just in the wilderness doing the best that they can. And we are very fortunate. These guidelines are great. You can quibble with them. You can tell us that their graphics aren't good, or there's too many tables or too many references, but they are very useful, and I think they should be adhered to unless there's a really good reason not to. Three, implement best practices to promote linkage and retention of care. Hard to do. Easy to say, hard to do. There's not a lot. We just went over it. Not a lot of evidence-based programs for interventions for linking to care. It deals with structural issues. We have to work on accommodating people, meeting them where they are, understanding their priorities, understanding their barriers. Lastly, develop strategies to improve PrEP awareness and uptake. We're doing that now. Each one of you who are listening today are deputized to also talk about PrEP, talk about PrEP at your clinic, think about, can I prescribe PrEP? How can I do a better job? We didn't go into the every 3 month thing, but it's pretty simple every 3 months. You're just doing STD testing, making sure they're not HIV infected. You can do it. If you can do diabetes therapy,
please,
which completely overwhelms me, you can do this. If you can do contraception, you can do this. It doesn't take much. Reach out to help. There's lots of help to learn how to do this. And then talk about it among family members, among colleagues, because there's a lot of people out there who don't know about this. I talk to taxi drivers about it.
Yeah.
They ask me what I do, and they're surprised that there's a pill that prevents HIV. We want to be so that you can get in an Uber or Lyft, and the person knows that already. So this has been really fantastic, and I just feel like this has just been fantastic for us to talk about and go over today. We covered a lot of ground in a relatively short period.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to also thank those who are listening in today and joining us. And I encourage you to visit CME Outfitters' website. And there you'll find a comprehensive list of a bunch of clinical resources, additional educational activities, both for providers and also for patients. So CME Outfitters is now on YouTube, so check out the activities and patient education there. It's time to turn the program over to you. Okay, so we've gotten a bunch of great questions.
Great.
Thank you to the audience members, the viewers, for providing these, and we'll try to tackle the ones we can. So we talked about Rapid Start, and I had this question too, because I'm not a big Rapid Starter, but I can understand the push for it.
Yeah.
So when we talk about Rapid Start for PrEP, tell me a little bit about, well, what labs, how do you do that? Like, how did they do it? We just said we want to make sure people are HIV negative, and we want to make sure they basically maybe or maybe not have decent renal function, or we could roll the dice and say you probably do, and the hepatitis B thing. So tell us how Rapid Start works for PrEP. If you're going to do it same day or near same day without laboratories, how does that work?
Yeah. So to be clear, I don't do rapid PrEP, but and the data is really, but I can talk about it,
yeah.
And the data is really emerging on that. So In that particular study, they did point-of-care HIV testing, right? It checked the box. The person, just as you mentioned, the person does not have HIV. They did an acute symptom screen. Anyone who had acute symptoms,
so
they could send out
for a rapid test, understanding the rapid test limitations.
But yes.
Okay.
Then they sent people out for a litany of baseline labs, okay?
Okay.
While they were waiting for the labs to come back, they gave people this 30-day starter pack.
Mm-hmm.
They were meeting with a patient navigator. I think that patient navigator, that continuous contact, is really important so that if the labs came back abnormal, they could then call the patient back and kind of update them. As you mentioned, it's relatively unusual to be walking around with undiagnosed, you know, severe kidney disease, chronic mm-hmm. kidney disease. So, also, we know that if people are briefly started on a tenofovir-based PrEP regimen, you know, and it impacts their renal function, that's reversible when we mm-hmm. stop the tenofovir. There's also the concern about hepatitis B, just sort of knowing what we're dealing with potentially before we start PrEP, because they could experience Hep B rebound if they're, you know, if they were stopped suddenly off PrEP. So so that was why it was really important for the patient navigator to call people back for the test results. But it wasn't
right.
a prerequisite to
right.
wait for all the labs before they got their starter pack.
Yeah, and right. The New York City Department of Health actually presented data on the rate of you know, contraindications or mm-hmm. the, you know, the patients who were started who
yeah.
then, you know, would have had, for example, poor creatinine clearance that then would have required them to stop. And it was very, very low.
Yes.
So, you know, really, which again supports the idea of, you know, the vast majority of patients who would be offered rapid start are, you know, they would do perfectly fine on PrEP.
Yeah, that's great. So I think mm-hmm. key thing is probably yeah. little harm of giving a month's supply of TDF-FTC, even in the worst case scenario, which is pretty unlikely. So in a lot of these rapid start programs, there's this risk-benefit tilt towards, well, we're trying to get people on it. We understand there may be some small risk of people having acute HIV or having a contraindication, but that seems to be pretty low. And we're going to get the test back pretty quickly because we are going to draw it, and we have good contact information
right.
on you.
Right.
Perfect.
And it's emerging data, right?
It's
the
emerging.
Guidelines still
right.
say do a bunch of baseline tests before you start PrEP.
Let's keep on PrEP for just a little
yeah.
bit, and then we'll shift off PrEP so people who are listening, we're not going to just only talk about PrEP. Question came up about bone health and PrEP, mm-hmm. and do we need to be doing baseline scanning, and are some agents better than others? So this is a really important conversation we wanted to cover that we didn't cover very much of. So bone health and TDF-FTC for PrEP, and are there alternatives?
Right. So we know that, you know, there is some loss of bone mineral density, but it's actually it's not something that is clinically all that important, except in patients who may already have, you know, osteopenia or osteoporosis. And even in those cases, you know, when if somebody is found to have osteopenia or osteoporosis, and then as they stop taking TDF, then that is reversible, you know, mm-hmm. for the most part. You know, what's interesting is that now there is we are likely to see the approval soon of TAF-FTC, and we know that with TAF, then the incidence of bone mineral density loss is significantly decreased, so which and also it will make it available also for patients who may have kidney disease as well,
mm-hmm.
so it opens it up.
I will say, too, the concern about bone mineral density loss with TDF is people who are, you know, on years of treatment
right.
with TDF
mm-hmm.
as, you know, as they would be if they were getting it as part of an HIV treatment regimen. And data from the CDC shows that people are on PrEP maybe for a mean of, you know, 3 to 6 months,
right?
Right? They're on it during periods or seasons of risk,
right.
not necessarily continuously. So maybe some of those concerns about the bone mineral loss is less relevant to
right.
PrEP.
So bottom line is we know TDF predictably can drop bone mineral density by around 1 to 2%.
Yep.
Whether or not that gets you across a threshold for fractures is pretty debatable, probably not. We know that in adolescence, it doesn't seem to hurt bone growth and final bone growth and plate you know, issues later on, and that it's reversible once they stop. So those are important things. TAF is something that is emerging. It looks like it might be approved by the end of the year, TAF-FTC as an alternative. That doesn't have the same bone signal. We don't see bone density changes. Not a lot of data for women, with TAF, so I think we won't know whether or not that's going to be something that women will have there will be an indication for women, but certainly for MSM, young MSM included, people of color, we would be able to see TAF maybe be used instead, and so that would completely neutralize the bone issue completely, I would think.
The DEXA has not yet made it into the PrEP clinical guidelines.
So it doesn't sound like there's much of a need.
Right.
So an issue that comes up when we talk about women, so if we're not going to be talking about TAF, but we'll just talk about TDF, is what about women who are pregnant or could become pregnant? What about PrEP in women in general and your thoughts about that with sort of the reproductive issues?
Yeah, so I mean, I think there was a concern that giving pregnant women TDF-based regimens might affect the bone development of the fetus. But actually, you know, especially if you have a woman who's HIV negative and pregnant and has an HIV positive partner, so a serodiscordant couple, like that is the person you want to be on PrEP to prevent maternal to fetal transmission of HIV. So,
So it's okay to
use. It's okay.
Everyone agrees, and the benefits outweigh the risk. The worst thing would be to get HIV while you're pregnant.
Way worse.
And we know women who are pregnant often are sexually active, and that they are at risk. And so if there's a risk, then it makes a lot of sense. We have good safety data on TDF in HIV-positive women who are pregnant, given all the time. So I think that even now, more and more, we're TAF as well. So I think that there's a lot of good data that support use of PrEP in women, including pregnant women, and we don't have too much concern. Even breastfeeding women, we know that there's pretty good data and there's safety there. So I think that's really important information to get out there. We talked a lot about PrEP, and I want to make sure we cover other things too, but there is a lot of questions about this. I think we went over some of the operationalization, some of the ongoing testing that's needed, pretty minimal testing as we go forward, not bone density. Basically, what we do, of course, is check for HIV with a test that's available for you. We check creatinine, I would say once a year. I don't think we do it any more than that. And STD testing, that's it. Mm-hmm. You really don't need to do anything else. And really, for just PrEP after it starts, it's really just HIV testing that you have to do. So pretty easy to do. I'm on an every about 3 to 4 month schedule for my return PrEP patients. Mm-hmm. I'm not dogmatic about it. And I'm even coming up with some strategies like come to the clinic, get your blood drawn. I like to do an RPR as well for syphilis testing as part of my STI testing and your HIV testing. I don't have to be there. Come in, I'll write the orders, future order, an Epic, come on in, get it done, I'll see it, and I'll rewrite your prescription. So it doesn't have to be as medicalized or as a doctor visit as we're doing before.
It should be easy, very easy.
We should make it easy.
But I think the frequency of the STI testing is important because we know that, for the population on PrEP, there certainly is a high incidence of STIs. But the good thing is that because we are then testing them, every 3 months, then we are able to pick up those new STI infections and able to treat them quickly.
Yeah, and there's been a big debate, and this is one of our questions too, about is there a risk compensation? Do we see more STIs? Data have been kind of a little bit, maybe a little bit all over the place here. There's some epidemiological data that correlate increases in STIs with availability of PrEP. Looking closer at some of those data, I've become more convinced that a lot of those trends were already happening before PrEP. Mm-hmm. So there's something more going on. Does that mean that PrEP doesn't contribute at all? I think in the Kaiser data that you talked about in San Francisco, where they do have a big PrEP program, it's what you expected. Overall, on average, they use the PrEP in people who already had high risk and who had a lot of STIs at baseline. Now, there were some people that you saw more inhibition and some people who you saw more disinhibition. Some people started to practice more safer practices and some people not so. So I think it's going to be on whole, though, we do believe that most people taking PrEP are people who are already engaging in risk behaviors that would lead for us to see STIs. There's a big topic of debate, but I don't think that it means that we shouldn't use PrEP because there's going to be an increase in some sort of bacterial STI. That's not what we're seeing. So I think that that's an argument that we should just be careful about making and understand what's going on. All right, so let's see some other things that we can talk about in addition to PrEP. People did have some questions about hepatitis C, and A big problem, of course, is, you know, substance use co-occurring with hepatitis C, and we've talked a lot about how we can engage people in care and localizing care. One question was, is the reinfection rate that you talked about as far as hepatitis C due to the fact that they have antibody? So maybe we should clarify that again.
Okay.
About hepatitis C and reinfection.
Right. So, yeah, and this is a point of confusion that, you know, for patients and even clinicians, you know, and we know that it's perpetuated because once, you know, that we have that as a problem in the electronic medical record, then it remains so. So the hepatitis C antibody after somebody has been infected with hepatitis C, whether they clear on their own or through treatment with direct-acting antivirals, that hepatitis C antibody will remain positive for life.
Okay.
It's the hepatitis C RNA that tells us if it's present, if it's that, whether there is active infection or not.
Mm-hmm.
So the reinfection is not really related to the hepatitis C antibody, but the way to check to somebody has if somebody has been reinfected after they cleared, you know, first time, is to then check the hepatitis C RNA. So we don't, if somebody cleared, again, because they were treated or because they cleared spontaneously, then we would check a hepatitis C RNA. Because if we check hepatitis C antibody, it will be positive again, of course. So, and that doesn't mean that they're reinfected. It's the hep C RNA that we need to check.
Right.
And importantly, that hep C antibody, which stays positive, as you said, for a long time, is not protective against,
exactly,
you know, future reinfections.
Yes, exactly, and that's a very important point. And we don't have a vaccine, you know. And in this case, the hep C antibody, you know, as you said, is not protective. It does not then, and it's important to let the patients know that, you know, if we treat them or if they clear on their own, that they're, if they engage in behavior that, you know, could get them reinfected, that could happen. That risk doesn't go away because they have a positive antibody.
Mm-hmm. Right. Very good. One quick question, and then I'm going to move on to another topic that we're going to end with. So one question is about emerging HIV care that will be more simplistic. This is really, you know, again, HIV is at the cutting edge of medicine in many ways, and as just mentioned, there's new modalities that are going to come available. Within the first quarter of next year, we will see injectable HIV therapy, so this will be intramuscular shot that could be taken at first every month, and then eventually there'll be data that support every 2 months. So this will be maintenance therapy. So people will have a pill-free option where they can just come in once every month or so and get an injection of cabotegravir or rilpivirine.
Mm-hmm.
And that may not be for everyone, but it'll be for some people. And again, there's all sorts of things we could think about piggybacking on top of that to help them with other issues that they may be dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, implants are also in the works. Maybe once a week pills are also, you know, on the horizon. So I think there's a lot out there that we will see. I do want to mention, and I think there's a couple of reasons sometimes we talk about things even if we don't have a good solution. And we haven't really talked about stigma, we haven't talked about racism, we haven't talked about structural issues. And while some of it was sort of a thread behind some of what we were talking about, I do think it's important to acknowledge that much of what we're dealing with does have to do with stigmatizing issues, including homophobia, HIV, being discriminating, people being discriminating against people living with HIV, or even hepatitis C, although less so with hepatitis C, I've noticed.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly people who inject drugs, people who've been incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
These are really tough issues. And I think what we're saying is we don't have a solution for that, but how do we deal? And what I talk about sometimes with my patients and my colleagues is, I can't change the toxic environment necessarily, although I might try, but I can try to help inoculate my patients from the toxins in the environment. And those toxins are prejudice, poverty, racism, injustice. And so as much as we can empower people, and that's why I harped on, you know, what was Justine's priorities, and maybe dental care and, you know, being free from her ex-boyfriend, or how do we make the front desk welcoming to our clinics and not cast an eye or shade on people who come in who look different or dress different or have a different gender identity. So I don't have answers. I don't think that there's any great interventions out there. And there's studies that have been done looking at different aspects of this, but they're pretty usually focused or localized. And I don't know if you guys in our last, we have about another minute, any thoughts about overcoming some of those big ticket items that we really haven't talked about? I'll start with Jamie, and then we'll get.
I think, you know, two quick things that I would say is, one, I practice not in my house. That, you know, you may have experienced stigma and shame about your substance use in every other healthcare environment you've ever experienced, but not in my clinic, in my office. And I feel really strongly about that. And so people should feel that they have really a patient-centered medical home that integrates care for them. And the second piece is, there is evidence for increasing awareness among medical students and among trainees, developing out education. Start them young, right? So that they don't squirm when they ask about injection drug use.
30 seconds left, Carlos.
Sure. And I think, you know, we talked about some of the ways in which we reduce that stigma. So the fact that, you know, now, for example, the guidelines and the recommendations for screening for hepatitis C will change, where we're not targeting just one group. Now we're saying, because of how widespread this is, you know, every adult should be tested for hepatitis C.
You make it universal.
Right.
Don't single people out.
And follow the science. You know, like we said before, the there are, we I think we talked at length about the fact that we should not be restricting treatment for people who inject drugs, you know, for hepatitis C.
Don't be part of the problem.
Right.
Be part of the solution.
Let's dispel those myths and, you know, get the word out there about, like, doing the right thing.
Thanks for sharing. This is really very, very important work. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.